Hello and welcome to the Whiteboard Rugby podcast. And this week we have swapped out Sam Roberts for the World Cup winger, Lachie Clark. Lachie, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here. Thank you very much. I'm sad Sam isn't here because he's a good old boy, isn't he? I love hearing his dulcet tones. I've done some comms with him, so proper lad. But I'm glad to be filling in for him.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for jumping on. We're going to cover a few bits today. We're going to look ahead to next year, to the Women's Rugby World Cup, and we're going to talk about the England-New Zealand men's game that happened last weekend as well. Just from your perspective, Lachie, just generally looking to the World Cup next year, how are you feeling about it all? Does it feel momentous?
Yeah, so Women's World Cup starts on the 22nd of August next year, finishes 27th of September, and the final being at Twickenham. So even saying that sentence is huge, and they're hoping for a sellout crowd. They've just released tickets and they've already sold 130,000 across the venues, and tickets are in hot demand. So I think that shows you how big the World Cup is going to be for the women's game. Last World Cup, they sold out Eden Park. I think it was 55,000 or something like that. So I think we're going to do really well, get a sellout at Twickenham. England should be in the final. As long as everything goes well, they're on a hell of a winning streak, 20 plus games. I think the only loss in the last 5 years or something is the World Cup final, but that's the one that counts. But yeah, women's rugby is going through the roof. We've seen the success with the England women's football team, the Lionesses, how the Euros propelled them onto the main stage and getting back in with sponsorship and everywhere. So yeah, I see the women's game that going that way. And Iona Mayer as well, he's doing really well, obviously, from the Sevens Olympics, has got over 3 million followers. You know, the women's game is going from strength to strength.
If we can just revisit the World Cup, unbelievably 14 years ago in 2010, which was the last one hosting England. What are your memories of that, Lachie, and how have things changed since then?
Well, that was 2010. So we had our home World Cup and we beaten New Zealand in the autumn the year before. So I'd have put money on it that we'd have won the World Cup. I was so confident. But the 2014 one, I wouldn't. I'd lost all my confidence. So 2010, we get to the final. Everything's going well. We play at the Stoop, full Stoop. It's amazing. Swing low, sweet chariots going around. They do the hacker. It's an incredible game. And we lose by 3 points. It was horrendous to be on the receiving end of that, but yeah, really, really tough. But how the game has changed and how the support has gone from that, where we just started to build up the media images of Maggie Alfonsi, Maggie the Machine, people recognised that it was female players and the game was being played, and to where we are now, you know, mainstream names up there and the most influential, top influential sportswomen, and you've got Iona Mayer up there, is absolutely incredible. So to see how that game has changed in those 14 years is massive. So when we get it back, obviously going over the road to Twickenham, you know, got probably 60,000 more people we can go and watch, and the games are on terrestrial TV and over the Six Nations and stuff. Just to see the game just explode onto the main scene is just so good to see.
So just before we cover the specifics of next year, so since 2002, I think it is, every single final has included England, and only one, that's 2014, has not included New Zealand as well. Is that a concern for the game that we tend to see the big two nations, I guess, similar to rugby league on the men's side, where we see, you know, Australia, England and New Zealand kind of dominate time after time?
Yeah, I'm not going to beat around the bush. Everybody loves to see, you know, a really tight game, jeopardy in a game, and it could go either way. And, you know, I wouldn't be against other teams being competitive and you know, the Red Roses taking a loss on occasion. I think that would be better for the game, for you know, the neutral spectator to not see a cricket score one side. So I would love it to be, obviously I'm a Red Rose and a Red Roses fan, so obviously I want England to be there, but I don't think there's any harm in other teams putting their hands up. And, you know, I think you'd just get the same amount of support watching a great women's final or great matches going up to the final. And that's what we all want to see.
Absolutely. Well, let's bounce to next year and let's kind of go pool by pool. We'll have some thoughts on each one and maybe a prediction on who might do well out of them. We'll go pool A, which has the potential to be really exciting. We've got Australia, England, of course, Samoa and the United States. So from the outside, I guess maybe 8 or 10 years ago, that would have been England and the US pretty much nailed on to go through there. I would say now it looks more like England and Australia to go there. The US seem to have taken a step back in recent years, Lockie.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I'm really torn because Australia is coached now by ex-Red Rose Joe Yap, who's gone out there, is doing a tremendous job. And I think if they could have her 6 years in the post, I think we'll see big things from Australia in another 4 or 5 years. I think they are just starting their journey. There's a big opportunity for them to obviously get out of the pool. And it is a toss-up for that second place between Australia and USA. Of course, USA, though, will have their Olympians, Sevens Olympians back. And the game is going from strength to strength with them getting a medal. So, yeah, it's a tough one to call. Could go either way. USA, very physical. Australia, very athletic. And if Australia use their Olympians as well, we've seen some great players come through that. So, yeah, oh, I'm torn up. Hard one to call. Do you need me to make a call?
No. I think it's going to be a really good pool. I mean, maybe just a word on Samoa as well. I mean, they are obviously the weaker of the sides there, but they are perhaps rising up, stick too soon.
Yes, they're another emerging nation, and my goodness, when you've played Samoa, you know about it for about 2 weeks. You feel like you've been run over by a bus. They are so physical. Every time you go into contact, you've got to give it your absolute best and hope you've got a pal with you because you're going to get driven back and smashed in half otherwise. They are brilliant. I love playing them. They get the best out of you. I've only played them a few times, but they will look to bring an edge of physicality with them for sure. Previously, when I've played them, they've only played sort of 10 women rugby, a bit one outy. So I'm hoping that they'll have expanded their game. But certainly the physical edge is going to be top for Samoa.
So you probably haven't ever been in this position, I don't think, Rocky. But as the weaker team in that pool, it's clear that they're not, well, I think it's clear they're not going to qualify. And it's probable that they won't get a win in that pool. How do you motivate yourself and what should they be aiming for?
Yeah, it's going to be about performance. And, you know, say if you're playing England, who's probably 99.9% favourites to beat Samoa, I think success would be trying to score some tries, trying to keep the score as low as possible, that kind of thing. They'll have key performance indicators that, you know, they might try and go for a driven line-out score against England, or, you know, their tackle completion at the highest percentage, that kind of thing. So, you know, you can see success, and if they could nab any points off of the other two, then, you know, that's what they've got to be focused on, because it's never, you know, it's never 100% that a team is going to win. Very likely, you know, you never know what can happen, but they have to believe that they can compete, and, you know, and that's how I'd be coaching them. But markers would be different to winning and losing the game, for sure.
Let's bounce to Pool B. So this is a different one in that there's maybe no standout, or there's certainly only Canada in this, I think, who are the standouts. So we've got Canada, Fiji, Scotland and Wales. So just if people don't follow WXV, so we had Canada in WXV1 who came third, and we had Wales and Scotland in WXV2, and then Fiji in WXV3. So it would suggest it's going to be Canada and one of Scotland or Wales, which should be really exciting for both Scotland and Wales because this is a great opportunity to get to the next round.
Yeah, this will be huge for them. And Scotland have missed out recently on World Cups, so they'll be really looking to get themselves in. And if they can get through to the quarterfinals, that'd be massive for them. Yeah, Canada are out and out, gonna take the race, I'd have thought, to get to the first spot into the quarterfinals. But yeah, really tight between Scotland and Wales. Yeah, I think Scotland maybe just edge it, but we're seeing Wales evolve and they've gone professional. So what can they do in this next year? And then Fiji, we've got that offloading game. They can score from anywhere. They're physical as well. I wouldn't write anybody off on this. I think again another hugely exciting pool, and we'll know a lot more after the Scotland Wales Six Nations game, won't we?
We will. Well, you beat Canada in 2014 for your World Cup victory. Why are Canada so good at women's rugby but generally poor at men's rugby?
I don't really know the answer to that, but what I know about Canada women is they are athletes, really good, clever athletes. Like the game has been evolving for them, say, over the last 20 years. And when they first started, they were maybe just like raw athletes, like 400 meter runners who'd come across, and then some power lifters, that kind of thing. But now they've got rugby nous now, and I think they're getting more and more dangerous. So that capped with a really good crop of players that have come through, like Sophie Dugoudie is a quality player who's played at Saracens, leads their team by example, and again Olympians with it, sevens medalists as well. They're going to be a force to be reckoned with, and I just wonder whether we might see them in the final. They could be that outside edge to get into the final, and they've pushed England closely in the last few encounters, so who knows?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating pool. And I think maybe something to be said as well here for how the organisers have arranged the stadiums or the stadiums they've chosen. So it hasn't just been get the biggest stadium where, for some of these games they won't be able to fill a massive, 40, 50,000 seater. And so they've had some here, the Salford Stadium where Sale Sharks play. They've got York Stadium, which where no union team plays, but these are quite small stadiums, but the atmosphere has the potential to be really exciting in there compared to a half-filled, much larger stadium.
Yeah, we've all been to smaller stadiums that are absolutely jam-packed. The atmosphere is absolutely bouncing. The crowd are going wild. Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. And what I love and what I think is really clever about the women's game is moving those games around. And they have targeted 95% of people in England should be able to get to one of those stadiums within 2 hours, which means it is hugely accessible. So from Sunderland down to Exeter, think of all those new fans that can access the game, and the tickets are a lot cheaper as well. So it's family friendly, and I just think people will be making days out of it. And we saw with the Lionesses the momentum, how it built throughout the tournament. More and more people were going, and sell out stadium at the end at Wembley just to see that happen. I think we're going to have the same with the women's rugby. Absolutely sure of it.
So, Pool B has a potential because there's going to be so many matches there where they're evenly matched. Any game involving Canada, you expect them to be the favourites, but for every other game, that could be really evenly matched. Pool C is a little bit different. We have Ireland, New Zealand, Japan, and Spain. So, Ireland, of course, an unbelievable victory over the Black Ferns earlier this year in WXV. On the other side of things, though, Japan got relegated from WXV2 and Spain promoted from XV3. This is going to be Ireland and New Zealand, isn't it, Rocky?
Yeah, definitely. I think you've got Ireland are evolving, and obviously being coached by Scott, who used to coach up at England Women, so he's bringing across that kind of, you know, the kicking game, the territory battle, that kind of thing. And you're seeing them evolve, and obviously getting the result against New Zealand recently was massive. And of course, they beat them in 2014 World Cup as well, which actually ended up knocking New Zealand out. So they did us a favour then. So I think, yeah, out and out, New Zealand, Ireland, and that game is going to be massive. You know, Ireland have a few over on New Zealand. New Zealand be looking for revenge. Who comes out on top? Who's to say?
It's interesting that you mentioned Scott. So that's obviously Scott Beamond is with Ireland at the moment. What are the changes that you're seeing in the game? Are we moving towards more kicking, more territory, more of a set piece game than it was maybe 10 or so years ago?
I think, well, certainly with England, our game evolved with under Katie McLean, who was our fly half and World Cup winning captain for at least a decade. Our game was about, you know, we had some real weapons in the backs, but we played in the right areas of the field. So she would, her exit strategy was so much better than the rest of the world. The rest of the world are catching up now and they're playing more so in the right areas. But Scott Beamon's area of expertise is that kicking game and that kick battle as well. We saw it in the men's sort of come about saying over the last 10 years, and the women's game has sort of maybe caught up in the last couple of years. And that's where we're seeing those maybe weaker teams evolve to actually playing in the right areas, and the scores are getting closer, and there's some results coming their way. And I certainly think we'll see more of it during the World Cup. But set piece, as we know, for the Red Roses has been massive, and they were guilty for a while of only scoring tries off of their set piece. And that's why losing the World Cup final, when they had a line out in the last play to win the game and they got it stolen, you'd have put your money on it that they'd have scored, because they score probably four or five driven line outs every game, or certainly in the high scoring games. But Lark Davies has notched up her try tally as the hooker who's going over to score at least a couple of games. So yeah, I think it has evolved.
Maybe a word on the likes of Japan and Spain. Obviously, two teams going in, literally swapping over. One will go up to WXV2 and then Japan will drop down. There seems to be quite a feel-good factor in Spanish rugby on both sides at the moment. Is there the chance that Spain can cause an upset here? And if not, what would be your expectations for those, or for them?
Yeah, I think Japan are very, very quick, very nimble. They play at a really fast pace. They're not the biggest of players, so they have to rely on tempo and speed. Spain are developing. We used to play Spain back in the day in the Six Nations, Five Nations, instead of Italy. So I've a bit of experience playing against them. And when we played Spain, it was always expect the unexpected, because when they were supposed to kick, they didn't. They ran it. And when they were supposed to run it, they kicked, that kind of thing. So I would expect the unexpected from both of them. Again, that is going to be a hell of a ding-dong between those two. Would you just marginally back Japan, maybe? But I wouldn't like to call it again. Could go either way, and I can't wait to tune in.
That was an interesting one with Spain, because obviously when the Six Nations kind of followed in the men's footsteps, Italy got added and Spain got dropped, which was fairly controversial at the time because Spain were the better of the two sides. And it's led to a fading of Spanish rugby, which is, I think, is on the way back now. But what were your thoughts on that time? Do you think that was a misstep by the Six Nations to choose Italy over Spain?
I felt very, very bad for Spain at the time when they were doing so well, and obviously they were better than Italy at the time. And as you've said, it's maybe been derogatory to their progress over the years, but the rise is starting to come back up, and we're seeing a lot more support for the Spanish teams and Portugal and all that on the rise. I don't know whether it's the right or wrong thing to do. I didn't know the politics in it back then, but I'm just sad Spain haven't kept their foot on the gas with it. So Yeah, whether it's right or wrong call, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it matching the men's is a sellable product, I guess, and less paperwork to do. But genuinely, I don't know what the right answer would be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess ultimately they are coming back, and the WXV provides them with a way to get one over potentially next time around on Italy, where they'll be in the same group. Which actually takes us on to Italy. So Pool D, Brazil, France, Italy, South Africa. So France, by some margin, the best team of those four. However, the other three, quite tight. Well, maybe the other two took quite tight. Italy and South Africa. Brazil will be a fair way behind them, I would imagine.
Yeah, and having played in the Barbarians earlier this year against South Africa, and they were brilliant, you know, I put money on South Africa, but they didn't hit their metal in all their games in WXV. They are a very physical team, and they're following in the footsteps of their men's team. Very strong, powerful scrum, physical in their tackling, getting line speed, suffocating, and big, strong carries. As long as they can get that tactical game right, we could see them beating Italy. But Italy have some tremendous players, worldy players who can unleash their backs to do tremendous things. So, yeah, it's going to be brute against potentially a bit of width off of Italy. But if they can get round that South Africa defence, they'll be all right. But I just wonder whether South Africa being so physical might be a bit too much. And Brazil, I think will struggle in this, and it'll just be a really good experience for them, and they'll learn a lot and they'll develop from this.
Again, this is a question which I don't think that you will have ever been in this situation, but we hear a lot about teams wanting to play, tier two teams wanting to play more against tier one nations, and then we sometimes see the size of the loss that they take, and there's a general feeling that they're learning something from that. I'm not so confident that there is anything to be learned from being beaten, you know, 17-0 or 100 points to 10 or something like that. Do you think that the teams will learn from that kind of result?
I think there's always a lesson in every game you play, personally. But I think you learn what it takes to be a tier team one, and learning how physical and how fast the game is, because it will potentially be a little bit slower, and the impacts will be a bit less. You know, I've dropped down from Premiership to Championship rugby, and it, you know, there's a slight speed change and the physicality is slightly different. But, you know, that, you know, would we benefit from playing a Prem team? Absolutely. But I see what you're saying. I would like these games to be played a bit more often so they can compare where they are. So you just got to look at the Championship men's, where you had Argentina come in against New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and they were getting humped 60, 70 points every game. And look, now they've beaten New Zealand, they've beaten South Africa. Like, they are, that just shows you stay in the fight, you invest and you build and you learn, then it can work. But I get what you're saying. It's not particularly a feel-good thing getting beaten 80-0. And I've done it many a time when I used to play at Henley down in the Premiership back in the day. And I think it made me a better player because I learned, you know, how to stand up in a team, and also what kind of pace and physicality you needed to have.
Let's finish on the Autumn Internationals, specifically last week's game, England-New Zealand. So there was a huge amount that came off the back of that around Marcus Smith being taken off on the hour mark, George Ford obviously missing the drop goal, which I think, you know, perhaps lays more than the scrum going backwards, all of the play then going backwards, and the pass being a little bit loopy. But when you look at that game and you see the result of that, where do you think the England men's team are at the moment? Because there seems a lot of good stuff about it, but then you've got the three consecutive All Blacks losses now.
Yeah, it's so close, aren't we? Just, I am excited for the men's international rugby, and England men are doing tremendously well. And what I love about Steve Borthwick, we know he had a certain style of coaching, and I love that he's allowed the players' empowerment to develop how they are playing. I do think he needs to do a little bit of work on his on his timings of subs. I don't think you have to make the subs if it's not the right time. You know, Marcus Smith and Faye Wabosu were both potentially on for players of the match, and they both went off. Personally, I'd have kept them both on, even if you'd have put Smith to fullback, just to create and keep that momentum and tempo. And, you know, Faye was just carving up all day, and I think you needed to keep those on, and bring in a less experienced scrum half on when it was right in the balance. But then, you know, you'd expect 40 to see the game out. But as you said, the scrum going backwards, the loopy pass, the, you know, getting them into that stage, it doesn't all rest on George Ford at all. Because if he'd got it, he'd been an absolute hero, and well done, Steve Borthwick, amazing selection, and, you know, change of the timing of the selection. But yeah, tough one. I think it was wrong. I think the timings were wrong, maybe too soon. My personal opinion, I'd have kept those two guys on.
We're going to talk about your career in the Blindside episode on Monday, but were you in those situations, particularly from a coaching perspective, where after the game you thought, I've made a massive mistake here, I've made a blunder, and if so, how do you cope with that? Because as a player, it's fairly easy to think the next week you feel like you go out there and you make impact, and you feel like you've set the rights or the wrongs of the previous week right. As a coach, it's much harder to do that.
Yeah, and as somebody who ruminates on a lot of things and overthinks things, it is really, really hard. And I've only coached grassroots level, where I've gone, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. And, you know, maybe the heart over the head has come into it. But luckily, I don't think there's many games that I feel that it's cost us. But certainly, you know, if you allow a team back in and you've gone, oh, I shouldn't have made that. But, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing. And, you know, we'd all be millionaires if we could win off hindsight. But, yeah, it's a tough one. But, you know, there were other factors. They were in control of the game. They should have won the game. And they were good enough to win the game. They just unfortunately let them back in. And that was a factor potentially that came into it. But, you know, the scrum should have gone forward and set up a platform, so you can argue that. But yeah, it's really hard to get over what you feel you might have done wrong, for sure.
Well, Rocky, thank you so much for joining us. We've covered the Women's World Cup, which will be next year, and as we spoke about it, it sets up to be an absolutely fantastic tournament. We will be back on Monday for the Blindside edition, but for now, thank you very much.